Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has performed extraordinary service to our country in the course of several phases of this war for the free world is, I'm very pleased to say, both a regular at this program and also one of our guests today. His name is Charles Sam Faddis, no stranger to these microphones, of course, but let me give him a short introduction. He is, among other things, a former Army officer, a former clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, a former candidate for Congress, a man who has written extensively, both in periodic literature, in published books, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He is also the driving force behind an absolutely superb online resource and magazine.com. Sam, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to visit with you at some length, Sam, especially given your background, about the performance of the senior military leadership before the Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday. By the time this program airs, they will have reprised their performance, I imagine, and probably not with much improvement, before the House Armed Services Committee. But give us your take and what you think the public's take should be from what we witnessed, what they recounted, and most especially what it says about the state of our leadership, civilian as well as military, in the national security space.
Well, I think it says nothing good. I mean, let me say up front that I think with everything that transpired yesterday, all that happened was we barely scratched the surface of how bad things are. But even given that that caveat, I mean, you ought to be terrified. I mean, to begin with, Joe Biden, clearly, no surprise, has lied, and his people have lied and presented a completely false picture, both in regard to the advice that they were given by the military and the real true circumstances of the withdrawal, the disastrous withdrawal. But I think it also paints a picture of senior military people that are not, you know, they're not fulfilling their oath here. I mean, let's keep in mind that as bad as this was, including the deaths of 13 service men and women, actually, this could have been infinitely worse because of the disastrous decisions that were made. We could have had thousands of people lost there, and you know, yet the military effectively did sort of appears to have made some weak recommendations and then acquiesced in really completely irresponsible decisions by the president. And as Lieutenant Colonel Scheller, the Marine who's now in the brig, has said, and nowhere along the line here did anybody put his stars on the table, stand up for the men and women that were being put in harm's way and say, I won't do it. I won't participate. I won't acquiesce.
And this is, again, I think, as I've indicated in my commentary today, something that will have the combined behavior of Joe Biden on the one hand and the senior military officers on the other will have a profound set of effects on both those currently serving. And again, you've been in the armed forces yourself. You have a very, I think, highly attuned idea, Sam, as to what it means for morale, what it means for a willingness to follow orders, for that matter, if you lack confidence in your leadership, in their judgment, in their competency, even. Talk a little bit about that and what you are discerning. I know you're in touch with people still in the armed forces, but what's the state of play as you see it on that score?
Well, Frank, honestly, you know, in all sincerity, I think you have put your finger on one of the most disastrous aspects of this, and honestly, one of the aspects that personally just hurts the most, strikes home the closest. I mean, I was in the Army. My dad was a career military officer. My brother's a career military officer. My son is a combat wounded Afghan Marine infantryman. You know, we're one of those families, and there are millions of them all over this country who've, you know, had the uniform on and served. And even after I was out of the Army, as an agency officer, as a CIA officer, I worked very closely with the military in conflict zones all over the place. You know, it only works if the men and women who are putting their lives on the line believe in not just the cause, but in their leaders. It's that, you know, you don't get up and expose yourself to fire just because the lieutenant told you to do so, right? There's nothing the lieutenant's going to do to you that's worse than getting shot. You get up because of that cohesion, that esprit de corps, that belief in, you know, that you, and what we're talking about is something that hits directly at it. And I think it honestly is a massive problem in the armed forces. I'm talking to a lot of vets and a lot of active duty people, and the separation between this class of sort of uniformed bureaucrats in DC and then the folks who actually are out there fighting the wars is just a massive gulf now. I mean, they don't any longer, the rank and file don't consider the Millies and McKenzies of the world to really be part of the same, I was going to say club, but it's more than that. They don't consider it to be, they're not part of the same tribe. You guys are something else. You're in DC playing political games, and we're bleeding and dying out here. And wow, I mean, when you get at that, that's the end of the U.S. military, really.
Uniform bureaucrats doesn't seem quite to me to be sufficient to characterize how these guys have been transformed into really political creatures. And it's not just political games. I mean, they are partisans for a party, I guess, but certainly for a philosophy towards the military, towards the United States. I mean, this spectacle of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by some reports, having something on the order of 20 to 30 calls with his Chinese counterpart. We've only heard about two, in one of which he's said to have assured them that we have no, you know, aggressive intent towards the Chinese, something that I'm not sure is heard the way we intended it there. But the worst one was one from February. And as far as I can tell, General Milley hasn't denied that he said what Bob Woodward has described, namely that he has promised the head of the People's Liberation Army that if we decide we are going to mount an attack against China, and think about that, folks, I mean, that would not be a decision lightly taken, needless to say. I think it would be under the most extreme circumstances that it would be even contemplated, let alone ordered, but that he would personally call him and tell him the attack was coming. Sam Pattis, again, you've served in uniform as well as, you know, behind enemy lines without a uniform. Just walk us through what the implications would be if we were to telegraph a punch that we were feeling had to be taken against a powerful force like the Chinese People's Liberation Army.
Yeah, well, disaster and deaths of a lot of Americans, and God knows how much damage to American national security. I mean, as you were speaking, Frank, I was thinking, you know, once upon a time, we would have thought that the idea that the Chinese would have an American military officer at that level who had guaranteed them to give them advance warning of an attack, we would have characterized that, I think, in the intel business as a spy. And we would have regarded the fact that they had such a penetration as absolutely catastrophic to American national security. And yet this guy not only did this, but as you say, he hasn't denied it. And in fact, apparently doesn't really seem to think there's anything wrong with it. And you just think, oh, good Lord, in what alternate reality do you exist that you think your obligation to the Chinese Communist Party to warn them of an attack is more important than your oath to defend the people and the Constitution of the United States?
Yeah. Let me drill down on two things that you just said there, Sam. and maybe in reverse order. Is there any reason why we would not regard or should not regard today such behavior as that of a spy, if you will, point one? And point two, just elaborate a little bit on this point that the effect of relaying such information could be not simply to have whatever attack we were mounting destroyed, you know, decimated, defeated, but quite possibly be responded to by a preemptive nuclear strike against our homeland by the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, that would seem to me to be decidedly a possibility. And without, you know, putting too fine a point on it, that could destroy our country and its people, could it not?
Obviously, it is treason. It is illegal. We should absolutely have that regard and that view about of these communications. It also would bring up the question of, having admitted to that behavior, for the love of God, why is the man still wearing a uniform and still there with that attitude, capable of behaving that way every day? And your description of possibilities of what could happen, absolutely accurate. I mean, I say all the time to people that I think we have lost sight of the fact that you can lose a war. We have now in Afghanistan, which submit to you, lost a war, but largely because, for all variety of reasons, we decided to make decisions and catastrophically withdraw. We were not defeated on the battlefield. We did not have terms of surrender dictated to us, like the Japanese in 1945. That is not the definition of how all wars must end. We're with a near-peer adversary vis-a-vis the communist Chinese. They're getting closer to having parity all the time. There is no guarantee that we don't lose the next war with the Chinese, like really lose the next war with the Chinese. Find that we're signing a peace treaty and everything west of Pearl Harbor now is completely owned by the communist Chinese, and the Seventh Fleet no longer patrols the Pacific Ocean. That's a very real possibility. And just telling the Chinese up front that we're getting ready to start a war, I mean, good God, on its face, it ought to, again, it's one of those things where you don't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, General, you can't say that and then tell me you're going back and sitting down at your desk. You need to say that and submit your letter of resignation and then hope to God we accept it and don't send you to Fort Leavenworth. That's what needs to happen.
Sam, the question that I guess arises here, too, is, if the Chinese Communist Party is actually not just a near-peer competitor, but has actually superior capabilities, at least in the Pacific, to our own, and I think that's pretty much where we are. I mean, look, we may have overall greater capacity, but only a part of our total capacity is in the Pacific. And the last time I checked, the Chinese control both ends of the Panama Canal, which is far and away the fastest way to get forces that we would have, naval forces at least, in the Atlantic or Mediterranean or those parts of the world, into the Pacific and brought to bear against the Chinese. But I really fear that we are still operating under the assumption that the Chinese are just aspiring to supplant us rather than capable of doing so today. So it just puts a whole different context on this kind of betrayal by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I couldn't agree with you more. It is unbelievable that he is not being held to account more fulsomely than he has, or that he doesn't have the integrity to simply say, look, I've conducted myself in a manner that is clearly unacceptable to the public and to the national interest, and I apologize for that, and I am resigning my commission forthwith. The other thing that I guess I just would ask, Sam, as you're thinking about this, is General Frank McKenzie, the Marine general in charge of Central Command at the moment, actually said in the course of yesterday's testimony that the Afghan war is not over. The war on terror is not over. So we not only have a situation in which we, I think, properly regard what's happened here as a humiliating strategic defeat of our country at the hands of these guys, but most especially Joe Biden, of course. But we don't even have the putative benefit of having ended an endless war. I happen to think that's right. We haven't ended it, but talk us through what the implications are of all of that.
Well, that would be one of the few things on which I would agree with General McKenzie, who I know a lot of Marines who have watched McKenzie's performance over the last X number of weeks and who want to strip him of his, you know, his Eagle Globe and anchor and consider him no longer a member of the Corps for his performance. He's exactly right, as you said. I mean, wars don't just end because you got tired of being involved. I mean, all we did was create a terrorist super state, right? And empower the Chinese and a bunch of other catastrophic things. But the threat has not gone away. But there's another element to this when these kind of his comments and some other similar comments by other people also seem to suggest that, okay, the threat is still there. And somehow or another, though, we still in some alternate fashion have a capacity to deal with it that is undiminished, which is, of course, a complete and utter lie, right? That this fantasy that's trotted out now that somehow remotely via drones or something else, we have the capacity to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a threat to the world, which is, you know, absurd, as you well know. We lost all our bases in country. Pakistan is hostile to our interests. We don't have a guy on the ground. Our human source network is non-existent. Don't tell me that you can control the terrorist threat there or that being able periodically to attack it in isolated drone attacks will begin to approach to be sufficient. I mean,
to say nothing of the immense arsenal that we've left them, which it turns out we've got several warehouses full of additional stuff that I don't know what people were thinking, warehouses that they were going to remain undetected by the Taliban. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Stuffed evidently with a lot of very, very useful gear, weaponry and equipment and so on. Sam, we're almost out of time. I just wanted to ask you quickly to come back to something that you touched on briefly a moment ago. Lieutenant Colonel Stu Schiller is, as has been observed by others, and I think you, the only man who has actually been punished in any way for this disaster. And his crime, if you will, was he asked for those who actually were responsible for it to be held accountable, which, as we've been discussing, they have not been. What is going on here with this lieutenant colonel, and what are the implications of that for all of the things we've talked about, including good order and discipline in the armed forces?
Well, I mean, I tell you, as a former JAG officer that tried a lot of courts-martial, they threw him in pretrial confinement. They threw him in the brig. What that means technically is they're getting ready to court-martial him. They're holding him in advance of court-martial. That's what gives them the authority for pretrial confinement. So they intend to drag him into court, and they will undoubtedly charge him with virtually every article under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, violating orders, conduct unbecoming, et cetera, and so forth. We wrote an article in AN Magazine and published it yesterday on this topic. And, you know, look, I think Lieutenant Colonel Schiller, when he walks into court, response ought to be, you know, disobeying the orders that are unlawful is not a crime. So failing to support unlawful and even treasonous actions on the part of senior military officers and the President of the United States, not a crime. In fact, it's actually required by my oath to defend the Constitution and just put this entire administration on trial. If you want to accuse me, let's talk about it.
Will this be an open public event?
Well, it should be a court martial. I mean, it'll be conducted on a military post, obviously, but subject to base access privileges, the public ought to be able to come in. The press ought to be there. And he, by the way, will have a right to be defended, not just by a military JAG officer, but to secure outside defense counsel. I would suspect that he will have a number volunteer to represent.
I will. And maybe your good self, if all else fails. This is a travesty, to say the least, of the First Order. And if it comes to that, I think you were absolutely right. It will be General Lloyd Austin. It will be General Mark Milley. It will be General Frank McKenzie who will actually be on trial, and properly so. Let's continue our conversation about this soon. Sam Faddis, God bless you, my friend. Thank you for what you do these days at andmagazine.com and for all your service to our country. It is extraordinarily important and deeply appreciated. God bless you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charlton.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is the Honorable, and I mean that in every sense of the word, Robert Charles. He served, among other things, as an Assistant Secretary of State during the George W. Bush administration, the latest in a series of very significant periods of public service, including as a naval intelligence officer and as a counsel in the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He is a good friend of this program, a spokesman of for a terrific group, the Association of Mature American Citizens. You can follow his work there and that of the larger organization at amac.us. And please join me in welcoming our friend Robert Charles to these microphones once again. It's good to have you back, Bobby.
Thank you, Frank.
I just had a very important conversation with our friend Sam Faddis about what's going on in and with our military leadership, and for that matter, the civilians that are at least nominally in control of that leadership. And I'd like to start with yesterday's hearing and just get your impressions of it, and then we'll broaden the lens a bit. Bobby, what did you think?
Yeah, so when we talk about yesterday's hearing, we're talking about Milley, Austin, and McKinsey, representatives at the top of our military, both civilian and military, and what they said relative to the President of the United States, which is essentially a direct contradiction. I'm uniquely observant of this, Frank. You said dispirited, and I'll tell you what I see. I'm keeping up closely with special operators who are trying, former special operators who are trying to get Americans out of Afghanistan. I am keeping up with those who are in direct conversation with Afghan allies who are in hiding right now on the ground. And I will tell you, the American public does not see clearly because the media report it, and in many ways because the lights are out inside that country, what's really happening. This is a layered tragedy. At the most fundamental layer in Afghanistan today, I am told that the State Department knows internally that there are 1,000 Americans in that country, not 100, 1,000. So there's another lie that's been promulgated. One of the special operators told me that there may be 2,500 Americans inside. There are also 100,000 Afghan allies who work with us, who, as you indicated in one of your commentaries, have targets on their back. So that's tragedy one. Tragedy two is that a White House that knows these facts and knows that they were told that this would be a tragedy, that they had to keep military on the ground before all civilians were out, they lied to the American people. President Biden lied to the American people. Vice President Harris ran away and pretended she didn't exist inside the organization. No public commentary. And then you have the implications of that hearing. You have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, in particular, and Austin saying that, and McKinsey saying that they had recommended that 2,500 troops stay there, which is, of course, the normal course of events. You have military on the ground until you have all civilians out. It's a tripwire. And then you have the biggest implication, which is that the Chinese and that the Russians and that the Iranians and just about everybody who has us in their crosshairs understands that there is a failure of leadership, a failure of integrity, and a failure of trust and honesty at the top of this administration. So that they see this as not only weakness, but weakness compounded by a lack of integrity that is still there. So should people resign? You bet they should resign.
Sam Faddis feels so strongly, and I confess so do I, about the wrongdoing that has taken place here in the case of General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, arguably with respect to Afghanistan, but specifically with respect to how he has been dealing with the top military officer of the People's Liberation Army of China, that treason actually is being committed with respect specifically to this idea of providing forewarning of any attack against China by the United States military. What are your thoughts on that?
But you know what? When I look at that set of reported conversations, and I've talked about it with others, it strikes me as really remarkable, because what it shows is a complete lack of respect for the President of the United States as an office or a person. It shows a complete lack of respect for the chain of command, an understanding of, and presumably, you know, that he's a smart guy and he knows his chain of command, and presuming that he knows what he's supposed to be doing and not doing. The fact that, at the very least, it's utterly inappropriate, but at the worst, as you say, it's really a breach of the chain in such a way that you are essentially adopting to yourself as a military, as the head of the military, you're adopting to yourself the prerogatives of the President of the United States. And so however you describe that legally, you know, this is one of the tragedies that we're also not talking about, Frank, and that is that one party government, when it gets in place, becomes a very destructive force very quickly. And what do you have? You have one party control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. attempting to pack the Supreme Court, and apparently with a sycophantic military. The other question is, where are the rest of the officers that knew that was happening and didn't say that they would resign as a result of that statement and action? You know, to me, it's a failure of leadership. It's a failure of integrity. And what I hope it's not is a progressive disintegration of these institutions in which we vest so much trust.
This is the thing that's worrying most to me, Bobby. And again, I'm thinking of your insights as a result of your own experience with the military. But Sam Faddis felt very strongly, and I think you probably will as well, that the impact on the confidence that those currently serving in the uniform of the United States military of such performances by their senior leadership has to be corrosive in the extreme and detrimental both to good order and discipline of those currently serving, and possibly a very significant impact on the willingness of others to sign up to serve. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so bad leadership. Yeah, you're right, and he's right. Bad leadership is always demoralizing. And when there's a failure of integrity within the general officer community, certainly at the very top, never mind at the very, very top, it's demoralizing. Most soldiers do their jobs because most sailors, most airmen, most Marines do their jobs because they love their country. And they do them because they signed up to do them. It's the lives of their buddies beside them that are at risk most immediately. Many of them have, for example, my family have many who've served. Therefore, there's a sense of higher honor. But the demoralization actually didn't even just begin here, and it didn't even just begin at that hearing. Mr. Milley has made himself, this goes all the way back to things like demanding that people understand CRT and adopt sort of socialist, Marxist, social renormalizing that is not something they signed up for. You sign up to fight. You sign up to think. You sign up to give your life for your country if you have to. And that is the reality. And that's what motivates people. But reality also is that you expect your leaders to have that same ethos, that same idea that combat readiness is everything. And I think what China, for example, is looking at and seeing is that, look, this is perfect information operations. They've got to be behind a curtain clapping somewhere, because this is exactly what, look at the absurdities that this administration, and if I may just list a few of them, look at the absurdities that this administration is propagating on the American people, and how happy China must be to see all these absurdities afoot. I mean, you've demoralized the American military. You have people recognizing now, look at the polls. You can see people recognizing there's a complete lack of integrity and competence inside the White House. You've got a border that's not a border, where you've got honorable horse patrol agents being called racist, knowing by a president, a vice president, and Democrats in the Congress that know that is not what happened. That's not the visuals. That's not what happened. That these men are just horse riders trying to do their job as law enforcement. You've got citizens arming to the teeth at record numbers with minorities and women because of Democrat-led cities having unbelievably defunded their police and seeing record homicides across the country. You've got American allies by the thousands and Americans left in Afghanistan. You've got prices going through the roof and inflation out of control with likely increased spending and decreased employment across the country. You've got this COVID controversy that never seems to go away. And now we know that the Delta variant, so-called, has permeated the 30,000 Haitians, which were 15,000 of which were released into the country. We've got left-wing control trying to pack our Supreme Court. You've got fines of members of Congress for deciding that they're going to assert their freedoms and not wear a mask, even while all these elites don't wear masks anywhere. You got 200 cities that were effectively on fire last year with virtually no response, and you get a fence around the Capitol because 200 people want to assert their First Amendment rights. And last, the one that really kills me most recently is that you've got 96,000 young Americans who we now know from a report last week died from drug overdoses, and nobody seems to give a damn. So, you know, China,
not a little
Russia
of that fentanyl imported from China, needless to say.
Absolutely. It does come from China. In fact, the vast majority of all the drugs that afflict American youth today come from outside the United States. Fentanyl, synthetics,
the new
heroin,
opium wars.
Cocaine.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and where are we? Where's the leadership?
Yeah. Bobby, well, I think what you've just described in so many different particulars is what I describe in the macro as a wrecking operation. Much of what you have enumerated is a function of American government policies, or at least inaction. And to the extent that there is so much of it taking place, in fact, I think it's no exaggeration to say just about everything Joe Biden's administration has touched has gone badly for our country, is harmful to it.
Well, and I think you, also
you just can't ascribe it to incompetence. There's got to be a malign purpose behind it, don't you think?
You know, you don't usually hear me say this kind of thing, but I think you have to understand that bad act very often, I think ascribing it to just one man isn't accurate either. Even if we were to give him a level of competence I don't think he's earned.
Well, I don't even know which man it would be if it were just one man. I'm suggesting simply it's under the guise of a Biden presidency that this is happening, but it's happening across the board, as you've described yourself.
Well, and I think what you're really describing, Frank, is a complicity across the board by Democrats in Congress, many at the state level, as well as within this White House and administration. At the very least, a willingness to look the other way, as Edmund Burke said, and we all know, all it takes for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. And I think what we're seeing is a failure of leadership together with a group within that Democratic Party that would like to see, I mean, led by the AOC crowd that's now really wagging the dog in Congress, that would like to see they'd really like to see a move toward Marxism. And I think Americans need to understand that we think our country and our institutions are stable, and by and large, they are. However, there are times when the risk spikes, and I think we're in one of those right now.
Let me ask you, Bobby, about two other things quickly. One is, again, as a former military person, among other things, a patriot, a man who has served his country both in uniform and in civilian ranks, when you look at what's going on with the military of the United States, we've talked a little bit about the leadership problem, but this critical race theory, or I call it communist racist training, vaccination mandates for COVID, mandatory vaccination mandates for COVID, which, by the way, I'm being told involve a form of the Pfizer drug that is actually only for emergency use, not that has been cleared, you know, by the FDA. That apparently is not available inside the United States. I had no idea this would be digging into that further. The purges of the military that are taking place, either as a result of people not measuring up to the CRT standard or refusing to take the passport, the vaccines, rather, the mandates. And then this business, we talked a little bit about it with Sam, of the trial, apparently now in prospect, of Lieutenant Colonel Stu Schiller. What do you think the likelihood is that we're going to break the United States military, this all-volunteer force, or at a minimum, at least convey, and I think you sort of alluded to this a moment ago, but just drill down on it with us, if you would, Bobby, convey to our enemies that we're simply not up to the job of deterring them or defeating them, should it come to that.
So there are really two risks that you're pointing out, Frank, and they're both very real. One is internal to the United States military, the morale and the readiness that we have as a fighting force. And the other is the perceptions that our enemies or adversaries have of what our readiness is, because that, as Ronald Reagan also rightly pointed out, deterrence is everything. So if they believe that we're not ready, they'll take risks they wouldn't ordinarily take. But the psychology of those who wore a uniform, and I did for 10 years, is that you join in order to do the right thing for your country. You join for reasons that have nothing to do with CRT. You have nothing to do with, you join because you believe that your contribution to the future in some ways is a reflection of the contributions of the past that were passed on at great sacrifice to you. And so the principle behind what you're doing as a soldier or as a sailor or as an airman or as a Marine, and the principle at large of having a military, is to fight and win wars, or by virtue of deterrence to prevent that fight. But the point is, readiness is at the top of the list, and readiness is not readiness to fight and try or to look good. It's readiness to win a war. And so the whole point here, internally and externally, is you have to be real to that mission. And when you have forces within the military corroding, undermining, demoralizing, and you have a president and vice president who just seem utterly out to lunch. I'm sorry. I mean, that's a bold thing to say by someone who served presidents, but I'm telling you, the perception is that they're not engaged. Go read, you know, Frank, I know you do this, but if you read Global Press, which I do, it is scathing. They don't believe that Biden is all there. Read and look at the leading institutions, media institutions around the world, which are reflecting the thinking of the foreign leadership across Europe, et cetera. So that's the outside perception looking in. And I think we also have a somewhat dimmed internal sense of esprit de corps, which is being run down by leadership. Can it be rebuilt? It absolutely can be rebuilt. And do the average person who is serving in the military love their country still today? They absolutely do. So I just think that's the saving grace, but it's tough because we're in a tough moment.
Bubby, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. We've got so much more to talk with you about. I hope we'll have a chance to do so again, and appreciate your contributions to this program, and look forward to the next one. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton. We'll take stock with him about what's going on in China and our own Wall Street.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by, I'm proud to say, another of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Bill Walton. He formerly was, well, I call him a master of the universe on Wall Street. He has successfully been a venture capital guy, but he is also now a conservative talk show host on the Bill Walt TV podcast, which is an absolutely terrific product. He is also a conservative movement leader as a former head of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very proud to be a member. He is a good friend of mine, and we're always appreciative of his participation in this program. Bill, good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, it's always great to be here.
Thank you. Listen, as a former member of the club, I wanted to get your take, Bill, on something that the Chinese were boasting about recently, namely the visit to China for 6 weeks, and apparently a very red carpet program by men, I gather you've come across in your former life, by the name of John Thornton, a former senior executive at Goldman Sachs, and now the chairman, I believe, of something called the U.S.-China Financial Alliance. And it's that alliance that I'm particularly concerned about, I have to say, Bill. Thornton evidently, came away from his experiences, or probably had them going in, as a matter of fact, with predispositions to continue the very intensive transfer of funds from U.S. capital markets and American investors in them to China, to the Chinese Communist Party, to put a fine point on it, for purposes that party has in mind, whether it's the oppression of their own people at home, to the violation of human rights there, of Uyghurs and others, to the, build out of their Belt and Road empire, to their massive increase in the kinds of weaponry that we were talking with Sam Faddis about earlier that is aimed at us.
Well, John's a former president of Goldman Sachs, and as we know, Goldman Sachs and Hank Paulson have been really instrumental in helping China introduce China to the world class capital markets, and has been an instrument in their success in attracting U.S. investors into China. And having Thornton make a victory tour through, or a PR tour through China, is a real coup for the Chinese Communist Party. And what they're trying to characterize it as, they're saying Thornton's trip was similar in nature to Henry Kissinger's secret trip to China in 1971. And, well, we could do Kissinger in a bit if you want. But, this is the Chinese are pushing back against any sanctions, what Trump was doing with trade, and all the alarms now about them stealing U.S. technology, et cetera, et cetera. And they're courting people like Thornton in order to maintain their prestige on the world stage, they think. Now, Thornton's firmly in the camp of the Larry Fink group of Common Cause of China. He's at Brookings, I believe, and And they haven't exactly been top. They're globalists. It's part of the Davos elite. And this is just more of the same. Now, I think you pointed out before we got on that he got to visit Beijing. And John Kerry, who came over to lecture the Chinese about climate, didn't even get into town. They kept him at arm's length. And I think they had a lot of their meetings via Zoom. So this clearly signals where the Chinese are in terms of being receptive to China, climate movements. But anyway, Thornton's there. He's been doing this for 40 years now, and more of the same.
I can't resist. I'm not sure that Kerry was there lecturing the Chinese on climate change. I think he was there importuning them to help him with his various agendas on the climate change front, and apparently is signaling that he's perfectly prepared to throw over the side, or under the bus, if you will, our concerns about human rights, genocide that the Chinese are engaged in, the degree to which they've inflicted upon the world this pandemic, their military threats to us, and on and on. All of that is sort of being, as is John Kerry's wont, sold down the river, shall we say, in the interest of improving relations with Beijing, for the present purpose being climate change, don't you think?
The Chinese see the Kerry's interest and the administration's interest in climate change. Of course, they've declared that as the biggest strategic threat to the United States, way over above Russia and China. And when Kerry goes there, they're willing to trade away key things like defending or stopping what's happening to the Uyghurs and that genocide. They also are being pressed to let China have its way with Taiwan, just the way it's had the way with Hong Kong. And so they're prepared to give up what we view as real American interest to chase this ephemera, climate change. And of course, as we talked about before, China's just last year, in the last couple of years, has invested $50 billion in coal energy producing facilities. And now it is interesting, though, China, they're going to be hosting the Olympics, they hope, in 2022. And they've just announced a crackdown on its coal producing, coal firing plants because they're trying to clear the air in Beijing so they present a better image to the world. This is obviously not a long-term strategy, but they're trying to, they want a PR moment, and they don't want the TV cameras clouded with so much smoke that you can't see the athlete.
Do. Bill, let me turn to one other piece of this, which is that the Thorntons and the Larry Finks, who has explicitly called for a tripling of U.S. investors' participation in Chinese entities, and the others, Dalio, Schwartzman, and so on, seem unconcerned by not only what has happened so far with U.S. investments in China. And as I say, by some estimates, U.S. investors alone have lost $500 billion since July. But you now have this specter of this meltdown of the world's second largest real estate entity, Evergrande. What do you make of that and the implications, again, for further investment in China?
Well, let's do the first part, the investor part. What people need to keep in mind is that China is not really investable. And if you'd invested in a Chinese, in an index of Chinese stocks in 1992, whether that's almost 30 years ago, you would have seen an average return of 2.2% annually. And you compare that to what would have happened if you'd invested in the S&P. The S&P returned almost 11% during that period. So China's been a loser for investors, the average retail man on the street, woman on the street investor for decades. And yet, if you're in the investment company world, you realize that, well, that's fine, but China is a huge market. There are 400 or 500 million middle class investors, savers, and we want to be capture that market. And so there's a phrase on Wall Street when you go on TV, it's called talking your portfolio. And you go on, and if you're long a stock, you talk about its great prospects. If you're short a stock, you say, oh, this thing's going to go into the tank next week. And you're trying to move the market to further your economic interest. And clearly what BlackRock and Goldman Sachs and Thornton are doing is they're putting their economic interests first and devil take the hindmost with regard to both America and retail investors.
As a guy who used to be in the business, how can you treat your clients that way? And if so, can you do so for very long?
Well, the thing they hide behind is they hide behind investment indexes. And what happens is the indexes are, these portfolios are based on the percentage of stocks in countries relative to the whole. And so China's 4% of the world global market index, right? I'm not sure about the exact percentage anymore. So that's the amount you put into your portfolio, and they hide behind kind of this mindless pursuit of diversification. Diversification is a good idea as an investor, except when you realize there's some industries and some countries that just are not investable. I had interesting conversations when I ran my company. The rating agency would come in and will say, your portfolio is not diversified into these industries. And they'd pick an industry like steelmaking. And I'd say, well, steelmaking was great in 1910, but it's not so great in 2010. And so we don't want to be an industry that have negative growth. And yet China, which is for the retail investors, had very little growth, is still something they push because, once again, they're talking their book. With regard to Evergrande, Frank, the property market in China, the residential property in particular, they've got 94 million unoccupied housing units. And somebody told me that would house about 25, 30, 40% of American renters. And so it's a massive overhang of unoccupied real estate. And of course, the banks in China are all controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, and they've been directed to keep extending loans to the developers because the real estate sector, China's GDP is something like 20-25%, which is way overbalanced compared to the rest of the so-called developed world. But even so, with Evergrande, I don't see this being a Lehman Brothers moment because there's no real markets in China. In fact, if you remember when Lehman went down and people were out protesting and on Wall Street against its collapse. Well, in China, they've told people that if you're going out on the street to protest losing money in Evergrande, we will arrest you. And so they're going to, and also with the inability to get real information on the internet in China, most people don't know about the extent of Evergrande's problems in the country.
The advantage of having totalitarian control of the media, it's the kind of thing that enables you to skate on some of this, at least for a time. Presumably, it'll be showing up.
Didn't Barack Obama admire that?
I think he did, among others. Yeah, Bill,
I think he did. Leslie, yeah, I do recollect.
I was in a conference over the weekend featuring three very interesting friends of ours, one a new one, I hope, two longstanding ones, Vivek Ramaswamy, the author of Woke Inc., Steve Sukob, the author of Woke Capital, and Justin Danhoff, who has just been working tirelessly against Woke Inc. and Woke Capital entities that are increasingly translating their agenda, the so-called ESG, Environment, Social Justice, Governance agenda of Larry Fink fame, into their corporate policy. And he's been resisting it mightily. These are individuals who are really warning that something very ominous is taking place in C-suites across America. And I think you've had a chance to take stock of it as well. Some of it's the kind of thing we've been talking about, the willingness to throw in with the Chinese Communist Party. Some of it's this so-called woke agenda, which is really, I think, just a fancy term for sort of Marxist, globalist, but at the end of the day, sort of anti-American, anti-free enterprise approaches to business. What are your, just if you would, quick thoughts on the state of American capitalism and its prospects?
A big question, but the short answer is this is one of the last institutions to fall to the left. They took the universities, K-12 education, Hollywood, the rest of the media, the social media companies, and those are very, very woke at this point. And the military and the corporate America was kind of the last place that hadn't been conquered. And we're seeing with Mark Milley telling us that white rage is the biggest threat that America faces. Mark Milley, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
We've been talking about him.
Corporations have fallen in line with that as well. Just an anecdote, CVS, the big drugstore chain, their outgoing CEO personally conducted CRT training for tens of thousands of its employees. And I think they did a lot of it virtually, of course, but it was the CEO basically making common cause with Abraham X. Kendi and his critical race theory and white racism. And so it's a big problem, Frank, that the corporations think that they've got to do that. You know, I sort of like CVS giving us low price pharmaceuticals and other kinds of packaged goods, but evidently the CEO doesn't think that's its priority.
And the question is it actually going to be able to give you those low price pharmaceuticals? If
just looping back to China, I mean, this is a worldwide issue. You know, the Chinese Communist Party just ordered Tencent and Alibaba, who are big technology companies. You know, Tencent's a video game company, essentially, and Alibaba's e-commerce. And they've just ordered them to put, I think, roughly $8 billion each into sustainable social value organization funds. Now, that works out to about 25% of their profits this year, which is a lot. But they're directing them to put money into rural revitalization, carbon neutrality, assisting with public energies, technology for senior citizens. In other words, they're doing all these things that don't have anything to do directly with its business and its ability to generate earnings for shareholders. And that's really mirroring what's happened here in the United States. You know, people think of the Ford Foundation, which I don't think it's directly associated with Ford Motor Company anymore, but that's become the biggest funder of all these, social reengineering projects. And you know, at some point, the golden goose gets killed if you keep diverting, investment dollars away from productive uses. And I'm not saying there aren't socially good things that you want to do. That's people's individual choice. But, you know, and it's just all this is masked, Frank, by the fact that the tech companies, the fangs, so-called, are absolutely killing it with their earnings. I mean, they're making $50 billion a quarter. That's each. And so they've got a lot of capital to throw at this, and it won't affect their profits in the short term, but long term, it probably will.
Bill Walton, on that cheerful note, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for joining us. As always, it's great to talk with you. We'll do it again next week.
Glad to talk to you.
Leave our audience yearning for more. There we go. Thank you, my friend. Yeah. And thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow for more of this doom and gloom and other messaging and information you really need, all kidding aside, about our future and what you can do to help it come out right. For that, come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station, if you would. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.